It's a rare person who does not take note of birds nearby. They are colorful, often noisy, and frequently fascinating to watch. We recognize some common behaviors we share with birds. They have to eat and raise children just like we do, but there's plenty about bird behavior we just don't get. Our guest this hour gives us an overview of the behaviors and the brains that drive them in the book The Bird Way, a new look at how birds think, talk, work, play, parent, and think. Jennifer Ackerman is the author of the book and our guest on The Exchange. She's a prolific writer on science, nature, and human biology. Jennifer's articles have been widely published, and her books include Achoo, The Uncommon Life of Your Common Cold, and two previous books about birds. Jennifer Ackerman, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you so much. It's a delight to be here.
Is it safe to say you could have made a whole career of writing about birds?
Absolutely. It's a wonderful and bottomless topic. And especially lately, there's just been so much terrific new research that's really kind of overturning our old ideas about birds. So it's a very exciting time.
So you do make a good case that we have birds on the brain ourselves in the number of terms that we borrow from birds to describe human behaviors. About we grouse and we snipe and we act cuckoo.
Yeah, you know, we have a whole slew of them. We're stool pigeons, we're sitting ducks, we're dodos and chickens, and and even some of our other terms like fully fledged and empty nester, that sort of thing. We're rare birds and odd birds. So, yeah, the birds are just built right into our language.
Now, the first bird you focus on in the book is the white-winged chough. I think I'm pronouncing that right. What is unique about them?
It's an Australian bird, and it is just an adorable bird, really. They sort of huddle together, very sociable birds, and they like to stick together pretty much in all of their activities. You know, they build nests together, they run around together, they drink, roost, play together. But they also, the basic family unit is a very tight-knit group it's a stable group of about 4 to 20 birds, so they're really very sociable. But when things get tough in chough world, they actually turn to some kind of strange and somewhat violent behavior. They'll actually ruin the nesting efforts of other chough groups. And the most unsettling thing, I think, is that they will kidnap and enslave the young from other groups.
Wow. Does there appear to be some biological or evolutionary advantage to them doing that?
Yes, so when it's very hard to find food, they need lots of young to help raise their, lots of other birds to help raise their young. So that's what they do. They basically take the young from other groups and make them help to raise the young of this particular group. So it's really about how difficult it is to get food in the chough world, and they need lots and lots of labor to feed their broods.
Well, you know, some of the biological functions are things we all have to do, but I gather you find lots of human behaviors, good, bad, and ugly, that we can find in birds as well.
Absolutely. You know, one of the, I would say the good aspect is there are some birds that are very altruistic behavior. There's a bird called the African gray parrot, which is a very smart bird. But some recent experiments showed that these birds will actually spontaneously help a partner get a little treat, like a nut, by supplying that other bird with a little token that can be exchanged for the nut. And there's no apparent benefit to themselves. They just give up these little metal tokens so that the other bird can eat. And so there is this altruistic behavior. There's also bald ibises, northern bald ibises, when they're migrating, they take turns in the lead position where the first bird is cutting the wind, so it's hard work. And the northern bald ibises, they take turns in that position, in the leading and in the following positions, and it's very egalitarian. So no bird gets too tired to complete the trip.
Okay, so they do share some functions. That's great to know that they'll be cooperative like that, too. You mentioned recent research, things we've learned about birds that we didn't used to know. What are some of the major recent findings?
Yeah, so there are all kinds of things that were kind of overturning. And one of them is that we used to think, you know, the bird brain was so small and primitive that it was capable of only the simplest mental processes. And now we know bird brains are actually these little miracles of miniaturization. They're dense with neurons. They're super efficient. And they're really capable of some astonishing mental feats. You know, birds can think logically and they can solve problems and they can make and use their own tools. They can remember the past and plan for the future. So they're very mentally, they have great mental capability, and we really underestimated the capabilities of their brains. And another thing is that we sort of used to think that birds could communicate only so much in a call or a song. And now there are some birds that are just blowing out of the water all of our preconceptions about what a bird can actually say in its call or song. One of my favorite examples is a bird called the New Holland Honey Eater. And when this bird spots a threat like a hawk, it lets loose with an alarm call that's just packed with information. And the call tells other birds what kind of predator is coming, where it's coming from, how far away it is, how fast it's flying, when to dive for cover, and even, you know, when it's safe to come out of hiding again. So, and the really cool thing is that different species of birds understand in detail the honey eater's warning message. So it's like birds can understand foreign languages.
Wow, that's amazing. I have many questions more about the conversational part of the talking part of birds, but there's so much more. The book is called The Bird Way, A New Look at How Birds Talk, Work, Play, Parent, and Think by Jennifer Ackerman, who is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back to the conversation, and you can join in a minute 10. I want to come to some stories about people learning things from birds. Jessica Meir, an American astronaut, how did birds help her spacewalk?
Jessica Meir is fascinating. You know, she got very interested in what sort of extreme conditions that birds could survive in. And she studied in the Antarctic. She studied the emperor penguin, and which is a bird that can make, it breathes air, but it can make a 27-minute dive on a single breath. So it can go underwater for almost a half an hour on a single breath. So she was very interested in this. And also, she was interested in a bird called the bar-headed goose, which crosses the Himalayas and twice during its migratory route. And this is a bird that travels at, 16,000 feet, way, way, way up in high altitude where the air is very thin. And she was interested in, well, how can this bird fly, which, takes a tremendous amount of energy and oxygen, and in this very high altitude. So she actually trained the birds to basically get used to her and fly with her, and she ended up putting them in a wind tunnel to study how they can flap and fly at these very high altitudes.
Really? So how did that help her in the spacewalking?
Well, I think it's just basic research, but she's interested in how humans can survive in space, in the conditions of outer space. So it's, these are physiological questions that are just fascinating, and birds have such a range of interesting physiologies and extreme physiologies.
They really do. And one of the things that really stood out about the Jessica Meir passage in the book is her studies of penguins and the fact that they look so galumphy on land, and we all make fun of how penguins walk, but underwater, that's a different story.
Yeah, she said they're beautiful, like dancers underwater. They go under for a long time, and then they just have this beautiful movement. It's very graceful and very like a ballet dancer.
Let's talk about another bird, Eclectus parrots. Now here's a story. They sound like they're rule breakers in bird coloring.
Yeah, they are. So that this is a very interesting species in lots of ways, but their plumage is one of the things that's very confounding for scientists. We're for a long time. These birds, one of the female is very bright red, and the male is very bright green. And for a long time, they seemed so different with such different showy plumage that the scientists thought they were just different species. Until one saw a green bird on top of a red bird and realized, okay, these birds are mating, they're one species. But they really do break all the rules. Generally, males are flashier than females, you know, which are usually a duller color, so they blend in with their surroundings when they're incubating their eggs.
Okay, they do get it weirder, though, because the mothers do what to the male hatchlings?
Oh, gosh, yes. The females murder their own male chicks, and only the males. So, you know, you wonder, why would a mother do this? Why would she take the life of her own male progeny? You know, it's a really fascinating mystery, and it says a lot about just how far a bird will go to hold on to its home. And it's one of the mysteries that has only recently been uncovered by scientists who are very intrepid and study these birds in remote areas.
So is there some advantage to, like, not getting kicked out of their nest by an adult male at some point?
Well, I think it's really about how the female chicks are a little more apt to survive than male chicks. And if things are tough, the female will actually dispatch with her male chicks and just focus on the female, because that's how she will perpetuate her genes.
Wow. Jennifer Ackerman is our guest on The Exchange. Her book is The Bird Way, A New Look at How Birds Talk, Work, Play, Parent, and Think. And I guess I never stopped to think, how many bird species are there?
Well, well over 10,500. We don't know exactly. We're finding new species, and also scientists are understanding, because of DNA studies, that some species can be split into two separate species. So, but it's well over 10,500.
Wow. So that's a lot of different birds. So there's endless fascination for people who want to take pictures of birds and look at birds and all that sort of thing, and many, many of them out there. Are many of the 10,500 or so under pressure, Jennifer?
Yes. I think it's the birds especially that are specialists, the ones that depend on a particular niche to survive. I think in particular of birds that maybe live on at a certain zone on a mountain range. And with, say, global warming, climate change, that range shifts north, and pretty soon it goes right off the top of the mountain and the birds have nowhere to go. And another good example is the migratory birds that depend on a very specific timing of a bloom of food at their staging ground along their journey. And if that bloom of food and their timing in reaching that point get disconnected, then those birds are in trouble. They may not have enough nutrition to get them to their breeding grounds in the far north.
I was made aware of this recently, the idea that the migratory patterns may be, you know, fixed and still doing the things they're supposed to do, but if they arrive at the time when the food is not there, that's a real problem for migratory species. Australian birds are in the book a lot. You point out early. Why?
Yes, Australia has so many big, bold, smart, and unusual birds. I think Australian birds, they occupy more ecological niches than birds anywhere on Earth, and they tend to be long-lived and intelligent. And also, I learned, Australia is where some basic aspects of bird being were born, like bird song. There's the mother of all songbirds lives in Australia, and songbirds radiated out from the continent and populated, you know, our northern hemisphere. And so many of our songbirds relate back to Australian birds. And there are also just birds like megapodes, which are very strange birds that build these huge mounds up to, you know, 15 feet high, and they bury their eggs there. So it's a very strange form of parenting. So it's a place of tremendous diversity and interest, I think, when it comes to birds.
Do you find North American birds rather dull by comparison?
Well, I think all birds are interesting, but the ones in Australia are just kind of outrageous and wonderful. And the Australians seem to sort of take them for granted. You know, they have these birds called galahs that are, you know, like little floating pink sunsets. And you just can't believe them when they float by. And, you know, the Australians are like, oh, yeah, another galah. You know, but to me, they're just marvelous.
They take them for granted. Okay, yeah. The book is called The Bird Way, and it is subtitled A New Look at How Birds Talk, Work, Play, Parent, and Think. It is the work of Jennifer Ackerman, who has been writing about science and human biology and nature for a long time, has written many books, including two others about birds already. You can join our conversation about birds, talk about things that interest you about birds, or ask questions about things you've wanted to know about birds. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's get into the talk section of the book. And you already said that scientists believe birdsong began in Australia. How do they know?
Oh, it's by really interesting studies of basically the DNA and the radiation of species. And so some of the birds in Australia are they're ancient species, like the superb lyrebird, which is, you know, considered the mother of all songbirds. And has a very ancient lineage. And so they've been, you know, looking at the diversification of species from DNA studies and have determined this pattern of the birth of songbirds in Australia, and then they radiated out to different continents.
So When you talk, and the talk section of the book doesn't just mean the sounds of birds. I mean, there are other ways that birds communicate, as you point out.
Yeah, they communicate through their feathers, you know, through positions. There's all kinds of bird communication, just like, you know, we have nonverbal cues too. But birds have, I think one of my favorite examples is is sandhill cranes and their body language. They have, you know, dozens of different positions that actually mean things to other birds. And, you know, we look at them and they just look like they're moving around, but they're very specific signals that have very specific social messages for other birds. So, you know, there's a position called craning forward, which means I'm about ready to fly. So everybody in my family, you come with me now. And they're on alert signals and crouching signals and all kinds of body language that these sandhill cranes use.
So it's not just dances for the sake of, you know, exercise or something. It actually is a communication kind of thing. Good to know.
Exactly.
Here's a phone call from Bill in Sutherland, Oregon. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jennifer Ackerman.
How are you all doing?
We're doing well. How about you?
Not bad. Birds are my passion.
Good.
I have a bird right here now across the road from me. He sings all night long. You know what it is?
No.
Well, there are nocturnal singers. In my part of the country, I live in the East, it's the mockingbirds that often sing all night long.
I've heard them in California.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
what do you have there, Bill?
So you don't know what it is, huh?
No.
Largest warbler.
Largest warbler, okay.
Yellow-breasted chat.
It's
he
a yellow-breasted chat.
He sings all night long. I don't know if he ever takes time to eat, and all day.
Uh-huh.
Right
now. Oh, my gosh.
It's amazing. Yeah, yes. Anyway, I was going to say another thing. When I was in the Amazon back 50 years ago, I found a bird nest on Christmas Day with eggs in it.
Wow, that's a find.
It was some kind of a flycatcher. It was beautiful. It was had yellow breast, and it had a mask.
Uh-huh. You tend to end up around the yellow-breasted birds, I'm finding, Bill. Thanks for the call. Jennifer, that's interesting. Is that unusual that a bird sings at night like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a phenomenon, but it is unusual. You know, most birds, they sing with the coming light and, you know, in the dawn chorus. One of those points that he makes about having eggs in nest at Christmas time is it's just an interesting observation, because one of the reasons that we are now finding a lot of new discoveries is that many of the studies in bird science were based on bird behavior in the temperate zones of Europe and North America, in the northern parts of the world. But scientists now are focusing much more on birds in the tropics and other parts of the world. So some of the behaviors that we thought were typical, you know, which is migrating, pairing up for these very short breeding seasons, and defending territory, like mostly through male song at dawn and dusk, those are no longer considered the norm. In the southern hemisphere, the birds do things differently.
I really found that part of the book interesting, where the scientists are doing the whole thing, well, here's what the birds around me do, therefore birds do this. And yet once they started expanding into the tropics and letting themselves get into sweaty places a bit more, they discovered, oh, wait, birds do different things in different places.
Exactly.
Let me ask about dawn song, though, because I marvel about this, particularly at this time of year when the robins get a little noisy in the northern temperate climates. And I wondered what the dawn song is about.
Yeah, you know, it begins as early as 4 in the morning, and it can last long time, several hours until the sun rises and the temperatures start to warm up a little bit. And it's interesting. The scientists have discovered that it often begins with bigger birds. In our temperate zones, it's thrushes and robins, doves. And in places like Australia, it's the big Australian magpies and butcher birds and kookaburras, birds like that. But the more important thing they've discovered is that it's the size of a bird's eye that determines when it starts singing. So it really is tuned to rising light. And so that's in the kind of order in which birds sing in the dawn chorus. Why they sing so intensely before dawn isn't really well understood yet. You know, it may have something to do with the advantages of sound transmission in the really early hours before dawn. You know, it's cooler temperatures, the air is not so turbulent, there's a lot less ambient noise from traffic and insects, and all of that allows a bird's song to travel further, and so that it can, you know, stake out its territory or broadcast its presence to prospective mates or whatever it's doing during that dawn song.
And that last example, it sounds like, is what yellow-breasted chats are doing. Randy looked up at birdnote.org, and it says that yellow-breasted chats sing in the darkness as they call out to the arriving females. So that should help Bill understand what's going on there. Now, you mentioned with the New Holland honey eater how specific the information is, and it's not just individuals. Are there ways in which birds do combine vocalizations? They work, in essence, as a chorus with parts?
Yeah, so there's lots of language-like elements for birds, and they do chorus together, they duet together. You know, one of the misconceptions based on temperate studies of a species of in temperate zones is that it was mainly, you know, males that sang songs, and complex songs anyway. Now it turns out that we realize in two-thirds of songbird species, females sing too, and they sing songs that are just as complex and for similar purposes that males sing. And so some of these duets are just between male and female are so beautiful and complex and so seamless in the back and forth that it's like it sounds like a single bird singing. And then you have birds that chorus together. My favorite example is the greater ani, which is a bird that lives in the Amazon and its tributaries. And it has a very interesting parenting system where it gets together with birds that are unrelated to it. Up to a dozen birds get together and they'll raise their young together. And the question is how they coordinate their activities. And they do so through this remarkable huddle that's like a football huddle that they do several times a day. They gather in a circle, they put their beaks in the middle of the circle, and they start to chorus and in unison. And it's this weird, wonderful, gurgly, bubbly call. and that birds start to synchronize their calling. And scientists think that this is the way they actually make decisions together, like where are we going to build our nest, who's going to sit on the eggs tonight, who's going to feed the chicks. It's a remarkable example of avian cooperation and coordination and communication.
Right. It sounds like a council meeting as well as a choir practice. So we have much more to learn about birds, and we're not going to learn it all today, but we have more to cover with Jennifer Ackerman. Her book is The Bird Way. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. I want to finish up talking about birds, because you mentioned the lyrebird in passing before as a significant species. In what way, vocally, is the lyrebird like the mother of all bird song?
Well, it sings like no other bird. I encountered this bird in a rainforest in Australia, and it was just about 30 feet from it, and it was a male displaying on its mound, and its song is this deep, resonant, booming, beautiful, and fantastic blend of its own calls and songs, and also dozens of perfectly mimicked imitations of other bird voices in the forest. So it can do all kinds of birds, big birds, little birds. It can do flocks of parrots. It can imitate groups of kookaburras. And it's just the most spectacular performance. You just can't believe it. And it's booming. I mean, it really is so loud it almost hurts your ears.
Now, does the lyrebird do this to mimic other birds because it gains some advantage in food or, hello bird, come be my dinner or anything like that?
It's mostly, the males mostly mimic in order to impress the females. That's the thinking. And females also mimic, but they mimic more alarm calls of other species. And it's the female that solely raises the young chicks. The thinking is that females mimic the alarm calls to keep away anything dangerous.
Let's move into the section of the book about work. And obviously this starts off about food, and it sounds like some birds have to work very hard to land a good meal. And you've described some things you saw along the way.
Yeah, that birds, they do work very, very hard. And, I spent time in Hokkaido, Japan with a bird called the Blackiston's fish owl, which it eats fish, but this bird really, really works hard for its fishy meals. And there are pretty wonderful images and videos of these birds. They'll fish sometimes for eels and bring back a whole eel to an owl chick. And, there are birds that, like they're snake eagles that will take huge snakes, and they seize the snakes with their talon. They lift into the air with them. These are like black mambas and, cobras, huge snakes. And they bite off the head while they're still in the air and consume these snakes. So it's seems to me a really hard way to get dinner.
Yeah, but they've obviously evolved to do this, so I guess they're good at it.
Right.
But wow,
yeah.
You also point out, as we've talked about, the evolutionary pressures on birds with climate change and other pressures created by humans. Birds changing food because of supply. An interesting story here. What the great tits in northeast Hungary have turned to a different food source. Is that right?
Yeah, so that was really interesting to me. I mean, you think of a great tit as just this little bird that, eats berries and seeds and things, but it was during a very tough time in terms of, availability of food. These great tits in northeastern Hungary, they took to eating little hibernating bats that were roosting in a cave, and the tits would just swoop into the cave, and they'd come out with a bat in their beaks. And eat these little creatures head first. You just don't think of a bird as tiny as a tit. You just don't imagine that it's such a fierce kind of hunter. But Yeah, I mean, it's necessity is the mother of invention. That's what birds do. They innovate. When they need food, they find a new way of getting it.
Right, and not just what they eat, but how. I mean, you talk about the ways that the birds have avoided poisoning from food. What are some of the techniques they use there?
Yeah, that one of the really good examples is the cane toad, which was introduced to Australia, and it is highly venomous and actually, you know, causes the death of a lot of animals that don't know better than to not eat it. But the birds, pied butcher birds and black kites, some other birds, pied purloins. I watched a white ibis actually eat a cane toad. But what it does is it avoids the poisonous parts, which are mostly in the back of the head and in the skin. And so what they do is they turn the toad over and they eat from the belly side. So and the ibises, they were eating only the toad's legs. So and avoiding the poison in this way. But it's really highly clever and innovative behavior when you think about this bird that's introduced to Australia in only, I think, 1935, and these birds have evolved this very knowledgeable approach to this deadly toad in just a matter of decades.
Well enough to survive, and it sounds like they're doing okay there.
Yeah.
Let's take another phone call here. This is Jack in the Rogue Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jennifer Ackerman, the author of The Bird Way.
Hey, Jennifer. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, birds are the best. I have a quick question and a comment and then a question around it. So the Clark's Nutcracker, are you familiar with that bird?
I certainly am. That was a bird I featured in my first book, The Genius of Birds, the book I wrote before The Bird Way. Fascinating bird.
Fascinating in that they collect and cache up to something like 10,000 different cache spots for white bark pine, and that they remember where something like 70% of them, something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know the exact quote, but I do know it's astronomical. And being from a northern climate for a lot of my life, I remember seeing them in the mountains in the middle of winter, and know that the white bark pine, they're their main seed distributor for that pine. And without them, the pine wouldn't do nearly as well as far as spreading its seeds. So that's
right.
Just interesting that they have such a unique or such a huge memory for that. And is there a lot of other birds and plant species that are symbiotic and codependent on each other that way?
Good
I'll
question.
I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, thanks for that, Jack.
Yeah, that's great. First, I just want to say the Clark's Nutcracker, I think, is one of the most amazing birds in terms of demonstrating a bird's capacity for spatial memory. So, you know, these birds, they can bury 30,000 pine seeds over in thousands of locations over dozens of square miles and remember where they put their individual stashes months later, even though the landscape may have been changed by snow, shifting rock and soil. These birds go directly to the location of their individual stashes, as the caller said, 70% of the time. Now, what is going on with that spatial memory? You know, it really puts to shame our own ability to remember where we put things. So it's always been a star in my mind in terms of spatial memory. Interactions between birds and plant species, I think, is fascinating, and there is such a symbiotic relationship. Birds are great spreaders of seeds of all kinds of plants and you know, really important in terms of maintaining ecosystems for that reason. So it's one of the reasons that I really encourage people to plant native species in their yards, because what happens is that the birds will feed on those native species, and then they will distribute seeds into areas that are overrun with invasive species. And the native species will be, you know, it will have a chance of taking over again. So it's a really, really important relationship, and I'm glad you brought it up.
That sounds great. So, you know, don't just feel like you have to, like, spread your native species all by yourself. You'll get some help from the birds along the way.
Right.
Let's take another call. This is Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, good morning. Three things. One is I really am deeply impressed with the ability of Canada geese to navigate in tight environments when they fly. They're just masters at that. And the second thing is we have four pairs of tree swallows here that they come back every year, and it's a very deeply impressive their exuberance for the spirit of spring. And the third thing and a question is, this year, after many years, we have not seen any bluebirds, and I wonder what's going on, if you have a comment there.
All right. Thanks for the comments and the question, Carter.
Yeah. First of all, navigational abilities of birds, also just a marvel. I think we don't quite understand that they have the ability to, yes, navigate through tight spaces and also to know where they're going. To navigate to a particular destination within inches of accuracy. And, you know, they do this with a tiny brain and no mobile phone. And it's really an astonishing thing because what they have is a mental toolkit that's the equivalent of our GPS, compasses, and satellite navigation. So birds carry all this equipment, and it's, you know, it really helps them get where they're going in a way that we're not equipped to do. And, you know, that it's to your point about the tree swallows coming back every year, too. They're returning to particular nesting areas that were successful for them, and they can navigate their way back to those places. As for bluebirds, you know, it's an interesting thing. The bluebird population around here is exploding. We have so many more bluebirds than we ever did, and it is really...
And you're where?
Because... I'm in the East. I'm in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because of bluebird nesting boxes that, you know, it was just one gentleman who started this movement, and people have been putting up nesting boxes for bluebirds everywhere. And the population has really taken to these structures for nesting. So our populations, now this is the Eastern bluebird, so it may be different with your variety of bluebird, but our numbers are going up, and I don't know about the numbers in the West.
Okay, yeah, it looks like we have the Western bluebird here, and its northern mm-hmm. range is pretty much about where Carter is in Wolf Creek, the northern edge of its year-round range. Anyway, I want to talk about play before we go, because there's some great stories in this section of the book. You start with ravens, and it sounds like these are creatures that really have a sense of play about them.
They do, you know, and it's wonderful because you think of ravens as these sober sort of dour birds that are associated with death and mourning, but they're also one of the most playful animals on the planet. You know, ravens love to play they love to play in snow, they love to catch snowballs and roll down snowbanks, and they love water play. They'll just, you know, splash around and dive in and out. They challenge themselves playfully by hanging upside down and passing an object from foot to foot while they're hanging, you know. And they also love vocal play. So you give a raven a empty jar or flower pot or something, it'll stick its head inside and make noises just to hear the weird distortions of its voice. So they're very childlike in a lot of ways, and I was just delighted with how much play there is in the bird world. And the most playful bird on the planet is a bird from New Zealand called the kea, and it's a big green parrot, and this bird just plays all the time, pretty much 24 hours a day. I went to an aviary in Austria where they were studying the birds, and they were just wrestling, rolling around, throwing sticks in the air, and hopping, you know, just they really are a lot like little children. And they have a special squealy play warble that they use to summon playmates. And it's very infectious. It's just like a giggle or laughter. When one of these kea hear this call, they just burst into play. And it's really marvelous.
Well, they are called clowns of the mountains, and I swear I saw crows enjoying a windy day a few years ago yelling yee-haw to each other as they flew through the sky, so I believe the part about birds playing. The book is called The Bird Way, a new look at how birds talk, work, play, parent, and think, with emphasis on how tightly packed the small neurons are in a bird's brain. It's quite an amazing organ. Jennifer Ackerman, the author who's brought all this to our attention. Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was a delight to be here.
Good to have you. Take care. That will do it for today's exchange. We are online at jeffexchange.org. Our producers, John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Student assistant Randy Babbitt at the controls today. Thanks to Randy and John for holding down the fort while I was on vacation. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Take care. Join us again soon on the Jefferson Exchange.